This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Funny jokes on me in my neighborhood because I put about 50 pumpkins on my front door stoop.
You're that woman.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Robert Pondicio of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Colin Kaepernick of Education Reform, Brandon Wright.
What does that mean in this context?
It means you're sitting down.
But I'm not kneeling.
Okay, fine. So who is, do you want to stand up? Should we do the podcast standing up just to honor America?
I'm fine sitting.
You're fine sitting. Okay, I'm going to sit.
And too. I like America and our flag and our military and free speech.
Okay, and also joining us is David Griffith here at Fordham, who is not taking a knee.
I'm not taking a knee, no. Not in this context or any other context, Robert.
I don't even know what to do with that. So let's just move on very quickly and get right to the education reform update. David, welcome as well. Okay, let's start. A pair of articles this week in the news on, David, your favorite topic and mine, restorative justice, including a major piece in the New York Times, have thrust this contentious issue of school discipline back into the spotlight. So my question for both of you, is restorative justice the next big thing or the next big education fad? What do you think, David?
Do I have to pick?
No, you don't, actually.
I think that it can be both. One of the things that I find frustrating is that we discard things if they don't solve all problems, right? And we adopt them based on no evidence. So in that sense,
other than
you know, right. So in that sense, you know, it is a little bit of a fad because I don't really think that there is a ton of evidence to show it works, but there's also no evidence to show that it doesn't work. And I think we've probably abandoned lots of things that just because they didn't solve our education problem prematurely. So
yeah.
So that's a giant hedge.
But I think it's a fair hedge. Look, you and I have discussed this for a while now. I think you probably know what I'm going to say. But to me, in the absence of data, this becomes a choice issue, right? As a parent, as a teacher, I want to choose the discipline system that works for me as an instructor or for my kid. Or for my values, as it were, as a parent. I think that's fair, right?
I mean, of course, how does that work in a place where there isn't a lot of school choice?
Well, it doesn't. But that's, we're not going to solve that issue here today. Let's just focus on restorative practice. I mean, you know, I've spent my entire teaching career, such as it is, working in schools, charter schools, for example, that tend to be so-called no excuses schools. And that, you know, that's a moniker that's in bad odor. But it's the opposite, I guess, painting with a broad brush, that's the opposite of restorative justice. And the restorative justice movement, to some degree, is it not a reaction to that? And there's lots of folks, especially of an activist mindset, who will say, look, all the no excuses discipline is doing is creating the school to prison pipeline, et cetera, et cetera. There's no evidence that it works. In fact, there's evidence that kids who are suspended often, all these bad things happen. So this has got to stop. I'm not unsympathetic to that argument, but I, to your point, David, I don't think that's the same thing as saying there's a strong body of evidence that it doesn't work. Therefore, let's all do this other thing.
Yeah. Well, let me focus on where we agree.
Okay.
All right. So I agree that the research tells us far less than people act like it does. There is almost no research that allows you to conclude anything really, in my opinion, about any form of discipline. Where I tend to get a little frustrated is, in fact, in this sort of, when we draw this dichotomy between no excuses and like dialogue and restorative justice. I know of no parent who does not expect their child to apologize and dialogue with someone that they've wronged. And I think that's an important part of building a community. I also know of no parent who does not establish consequences when a kid misbehaves. And we can debate whether suspension is the best way to do that, but we just simply have to get past this really cultural division between, you know, the tough people and the soft, squishy, loving people. It's because it's silly. And I also agree that, you know, in the absence of data, we should sort of bow to people on the ground who are just trying to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree on all those things. As for values, I mean, I think we have to set some boundaries around what's possible, simply because there's so many conflicting values here, right? There's the value of the individual kid versus the group. So it's complicated. But I agree with a lot of what you said, and I think I don't know. I just hope that we can continue to talk about it because and stop just, yeah, you know,
I think you make a good
projecting
point. And the one nuance I would add to that is, and I speak again as a teacher, it is very difficult to impose one or the other on an unwilling faculty. In other words, in the absence of evidence, I think the last thing you want to do, and frankly, the first thing that probably will happen, because we see this over and over again, is somebody sees an article like the one that I alluded to in the New York Times and says, oh, look, they're having great results with this, and they'll name some city that nobody's ever been to. We should do that here. Then comes the professional development. Then the teacher sitting there with their arms crossed saying, wait a minute, you want me to sit around in a circle? And it just turns into nothing. Because the teachers aren't bought into it. Parents may be skeptical. You have to win hearts and minds, I believe, earnestly, before you can make anything work at the classroom level, especially something as touchy as discipline.
I'd also like to add that I think it's important to acknowledge that there probably isn't a single right way to do this.
Sure.
For different areas, different schools, different states, et cetera, inside the boundaries that David talked about, there should be different ways that schools can approach this that either works better for different groups or maybe is just right, right? Like, yep. Perhaps it's not always about what works. Maybe it's about what the community wants,
right?
What parents want, what teachers want. And then if it works, fine. But as David has pointed out, we're probably not going to be able to find exactly how well System A works versus System B if they're both within the acceptable boundaries.
Yep. The older I get in this work, the more reluctant I am to impose orthodoxies upon others, even my own orthodoxies. So, you know, I to your point, I think it's a good idea to have lots of options to explore these things. But I share your skepticism, David, about the data. And the thing that I fear is what we always hear is people saying, well, it worked thus and thus in such a place, so let's do it here. That's almost always when the alarm bell should ring.
Okay. Beware of anecdotes.
Beware of anecdotes masquerading as proof. All right. If you thought that restorative justice was a controversial issue, we're just getting started. Let's talk about Donald Trump, shall we, gentlemen? Last week, I can't remember where he gave this speech, but he put forth an actual proposal, like Donald Trump, you know, a real idea.
It was Cleveland. Somewhere in Ohio.
At a charter school. That's right. In Cleveland, Ohio. Put forth a $20 billion proposal to promote school choice. So here's my question. Could Trump actually be the school choice president?
Sure. I mean, if somehow he can win the office and then
details, Brandon.
And then get this plan passed. And part of the plan is for states to buy in. So the federal money, I believe, is $20 billion, but then the state money is $110 billion.
Right.
I'm not going to do the math off the top of my head, but there's 43 states in DC that currently have school choice. I imagine those would be the states that are participating more so. Schools.
I'm looking while you're speaking at the statement that was released by the campaign, and I don't see it in here, but there was a news report, I think from Bloomberg News, that quoted Trump, probably from the event in Cleveland, saying something to the effect that this would favor or states that that have school choice would be favored. So that implied to me a kind of school choice race to the top. And if that's what he has in mind, color me intrigued. In the same way that race to the top incentivized all these different things, you know, accountability, common core, et cetera, et cetera. I can't think of any reason why you couldn't have a school choice race to the top that would reward states for lifting their charter caps, et cetera, putting in place the policies that would really open up a legitimate market.
So I think I might push back a little bit there. Okay. If the plan is put into practice, I'd prefer that it not be a competition with all of these conditions attached. Hmm. I'd prefer that the federal government doesn't define exactly how choice should play out in the 50 states. I'd prefer there to be less conditions. And sort of like ESSA has done, leave it up to states to decide how school choice might work best in their state.
But couldn't it be argued, and I'm not sure who made this argument, it wasn't me, I'm not that clever, someone observed that race to the top promoted or got in place a whole lot of reform for very little money simply by making it a condition to even apply.
Certainly possible, but I guess I'm just saying that when it comes to school choice, charters, vouchers, backpack funding, et cetera, all these things that go into Trump's plan, I guess I'm saying that I don't want the federal government to be the one who's saying these components are the best. These reforms are best. If you just say, let's expand school choice, let's expand options, and right, put something into place that makes sure that these schools are high quality, that's sort of where I want the federal government to stop. And if that's the case, then I don't think it could be a race to the top like competition.
It certainly, I mean, this is my surmise. I should be clear. I didn't see anything coming from the Trump campaign that used that formulation, a school choice race to the top. But I'm trying to talk something into reality.
Yeah, you know, I think
Trump,
both of our ideas are possible.
Yeah.
I'm saying that I don't want it to be a race to the top like competition.
Here's all.
Whereas it's perfectly fine that you do.
You can't even convince the people at Ford.
Ow.
Yeah. It's going to be a tough road.
Wow. I wish I had a good comeback for that. But, David, you may have just sealed the deal or unsealed it. I color me humbled. But look, my last word on this. Somebody asked me, wait, would you vote for Trump if it meant backpack funding for every child? I said, dude, I'd vote for Lucifer if it meant backpack funding was universal in this country. But that's just me. Your mileage will vary. Brandon Wright, apparently your mileage does vary.
What does that mean?
I have, to David's point, I haven't convinced my own colleague here at Fordham of the wisdom of my grand plan. So I think I'm done. And that is all the time we have for the education reform update. Up next is Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back, Amber.
Thank you very much, Robert.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day. I'm hoping summer just kind of hangs on for a little while longer.
There was a little touch of fall in my around my home in upstate New York, and I found myself thinking, I'm ready for this.
Not so much. Although I love pumpkins. Everybody jokes on me in my neighborhood because I put about 50 pumpkins on my front door stoop.
You're that woman.
I am that woman.
Okay.
Like, you carve them too?
There's not a pumpkin I don't like. I like orange ones, white ones, big tops, little tops. I am the crazy pumpkin woman. Yes.
Gourds and whatnot too?
Gourds. Gotta love a gourd. There's not a never met a gourd I didn't love.
I feel like I should have a witty comeback for that. But let's just move on. What you got for us this week?
All right. We got a new report from Tulane University's Education Research Alliance that seeks to shed light on authorizer impact in post-Katrina New Orleans. So in other words, does the process by which applications are reviewed help to produce effective charter schools, right? So what do the authorizers do when they're reviewing an application and the decisions that they make? Does it have anything to do with the likelihood of a school being effective on down the line?
I'm going to guess yes.
And second part, after those schools have been initially authorized, does that same process also shed light on which types of charters get renewed? Okay. All right. Before we get into the findings, two quick caveats. Number one, post-Katrina authorizing environment in New Orleans was like nowhere else, right?
Of course.
Because Louisiana, just let's take a little trip back in time. Louisiana had given control of almost all of New Orleans public schools to the state board and the Recovery School District. And the independent review of charter applications was mandated by state law. Okay, so it was in law. They had a gazillion organizations apply to open a new charter. And so they had to have some help. So they asked NACSA, National Association of Charter School Authorizers, to review and rate the applications. Okay. And in most cases, lo and behold, the state followed NACSA's recommendations. Second, quick little caveat. It's not really a caveat, it's just context, okay? NACSA examined much more than the charter applications themselves. So it wasn't just like you look at 1,000 pages of application online. They also interviewed the folks opening the school and did site visits where they were going to open them and yada, yada.
Did their due diligence.
And that's right. So the approval and renewal data are informed by more than the online or paper application alone, okay? Findings, I'm finally there. Number one, the authors found that the only factor predicting both charter approval and renewal is the school's rating from NACSA. Not surprising, right? That's why they hired the people, right?
Okay. You think? Water is wet.
Interestingly, that's a hard word for me to say. Interestingly, the authors listed a number of application factors that had no effect on application approval or renewal, including number of board members with backgrounds in education. Didn't do one thing or the other. Whether partners were for-profit or non-profit.
Oh, that's interesting.
Whether a national CMO was involved.
You would think that might.
That would little credibility boost.
Whether a principal had been identified. Didn't nothing there. How many minutes of instruction the school planned to have, as well as the number of professional development hours they planned. So none of that, either way or the other, had no effect on whether the application was approved or renewed. Okay. And also
weren't some of those part of the NACSA guidelines?
Apparently that's the things that the researchers chose to use.
Okay.
Now, whether or not some of those things were rolled up into the NACSA rating, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, there does not appear to be a link between the application factors and future school performance. All right.
That doesn't surprise me.
There's that. And then they looked at charter renewal. So that was both approval and renewal. And then, so in other words, after NACSA has done its job, it appears that what is most predictive is the performance score, which is the state's proficiency grade, right? And the value added growth measure. So you would think, of course, those things would predict whether the charter is going to be renewed. That's not surprising. And while charters with higher enrollment growth were more likely to be renewed, because now we're talking about, okay, what do parents, what's a parent proxy? Enrollment levels themselves were not a factor in renewal decisions. So anyway, then they talk about, why the study has a bunch of limitations. You know, first of all, they just kind of pulled, like your question, Robert, they just kind of pulled these factors out of thin air because they were things that could easily measure in the application. So it could be like a gazillion other things that we did measure and can't measure. And the ability to observe the performance of only the strongest applications. So in other words, we don't have the worst applications in there. So if you're trying to test whether the application materials predict future performance, you've got a lot of applications that you can't, the bad ones aren't in there to begin with. Catherine, who is our head of our sponsorship on what schools that we authorize in Ohio, she took a look and she said, I think this kind of means there's a secret sauce there, but the applications themselves, just on the paper application, really doesn't help you kind of figure out what the secret sauce is, right? You really need to go in, talk to people, go face to face, see who these people are, see what they're made of, right? And that'll help you kind of determine the likelihood of success.
I'm embarrassed. I don't know the answer to this question, but I'm not sure if it's ever been studied in any rigorous way or even how you would study it. But how do you compare the paper plan, as it were, the application for a school, to whether the school end up looking like that or not? Thinking of the old Mike Tyson joke about everybody's got a plan and then you get punched in the mouth.
Right. And what does it look like later? Yeah. No, I think it's a great question. I mean, I'm on a charter school board here in DC, and I can tell you already our strategic plan looks nothing like what it was going to look when we first asked to be open.
Exactly.
Matter of fact, we thought we were going to have something like 90% of all kids, proficient and achieving a 4+ on whatever state test was in use.
Says
the time.
So right here on paper.
So now it's more like, we're going to do what the heck the DCPS charter school board tells us we got to do to stay open, right?
So I don't want to be unkind to our colleagues here at Tulane, but isn't this kind of an odd thing to even look at?
Well, I mean, hello, Robert. We have a study very similar to this study in the works.
Okay. That's all the time we have for this week.
But what I'm going to say is we're looking at a lot more applications and a lot more states. We think it's going to be a little bit more robust.
Yeah.
Look than this one. Not that this one isn't great, because I think this one was pioneering in its own way. But we're also going to try to figure out the combination of factors. So not just looking at these things in isolation, but is there a combo of factors that might predict these things? So in other words, trying to be a little bit more nuanced in these things. So
no, I don't want to make light of it, but it does seem to me that what I'm interested in is when there are variations between the plan and the actual practice. What got in the way? What was the disconnect between the concept and the implementation?
Yeah, but I mean, it's reality.
Of course,
right?
But shouldn't that help you write better applications?
Yeah, you would think. So in other words, you're saying that somebody who's already operated schools would have a better likelihood of having a successful application. And actually
think that
they had that as a factor, the number of prior applications approved.
Okay.
And I don't think it predicted anything, which is odd, because I'm with you, because you would think experience gives you a whole level of expertise you'd be able to reflect in an application that you wouldn't otherwise. But I don't quote me on that, but I think that's another one that they coded. I didn't list all of them that may have not predicted much of anything.
I don't need to quote you. It's on the podcast available online until the sun goes out.
That's right.
There it is.
That's all I got.
And that's all the time we have for this week's Gadfly Show. Till next week.
I'm Brandon Wright.
And I'm Robert Mendocino for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.